Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you, Mr. Rodson, and good morning to everyone. As always, I wish we could be together in the courtroom in Jacksonville, but this is where we are for the time being. I'm happy this week to be with my two colleagues, Judge Brasher and Judge Luck. I welcome counsel as well. I hope you got word, and I think you got belated word, but we are going to allow counsel the first 2 minutes of your argument to go uninterrupted. Will tell you that I'm going to enforce the time limits that you're familiar with. And with that, I'll call the first case. It's Luther McKeever versus Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Rachel Reese, and I represent the appellant Luther McKeever in this matter. Mr. McKeever is currently an inmate in the state of Florida, serving a 25-year mandatory prison sentence after he was convicted of trafficking in oxycodone. Mr. McKeever was accused and convicted of breaking into his neighbor John Sneed's residence and stealing several prescription pill bottles and the pills inside those bottles. Mr. McKeever pled guilty to 2 counts of burglary and 1 count of theft. That those charges arose out of the same incident as the trafficking incident. However, he chose to proceed to trial on the trafficking charge because the issue in dispute was how many pills were actually taken and whether or not he could be found guilty of the trafficking amount, which would then put him at risk for the 25-year mandatory sentence that he now is serving. The state's theory of its case was that Mr. Sneed had either 112 or 114 pills left inside the bottle when the burglary took place. However, neither the pill bottles or the pills were ever recovered by law enforcement, and the only testimony that was offered by the state to establish the number of pills was the pharmacist who filled the prescription several days earlier and from Mr. Sneed himself. Mr. McKeever admitted to the jury to breaking into Mr. Sneed's residence. He admitted to taking the pills, the bottle, and whatever was left. However, the defense's theory was still that the state could not prove, because no one knew, how many pills were actually inside the bottle when they were taken by Mr. McKeever. Mr. McKeever filed a motion for post-conviction relief back in the state of Florida, the 5th Judicial Circuit for Citrus County, and his motion claimed several grounds of ineffective counsel, and it was granted on 2 of those grounds. However, the 5th District Court of Appeal later reversed that order and found specifically that Mr. McKeever failed to meet his burden under either of the prongs under Strickland. Now, the issues became the crux of the issues in the petition filed by Mr. McKeever with the district court, and now before Your Honors in the appeal before you today. Now, the two claims that were filed by Mr. McKeever, one was that counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate witnesses. The other was that counsel was ineffective for failing to call witnesses. Both of them were filed separately, but were considered jointly by the district court and jointly in our briefs. And it is our position that the district court erred in denying both of those claims because the state court's application of Strickland was unreasonable in light of the facts that were present to the state court.
Now, can I ask you to address something?
Yes, Your Honor.
On that claim that the state courts actually passed on. So we don't know why the state appellate court did what it did, but one of the things that the state argued to the appellate court was that Mr. McKeever hadn't met his burden of proof because he didn't present testimony from the witnesses as to what they would have said had they been called. Isn't that, if that was the reason that the state court did what it did, why isn't that a reasonable construction of Strickland?
And Your Honor is correct. We don't know why the 5th District Court of Appeal ruled the way that they did. They didn't provide any legal analysis or any other findings. So as to that position, obviously the state alleged that below, and it's continuing to argue that fact now. And because we don't know, obviously the court's review of the record is to look at it de novo and to make factual, make those determinations based on the law. And it's our position that the testimony from the evidentiary hearing and the record before the court, before the 5th District Court of Appeal, was enough to establish the prejudice prong under Strickland, because the Mr. McKeever obviously testified about what these witnesses would have advised counsel if he had investigated them, specifically the fact that they had bought drugs for Mr. Sneed in the past, that Mr. Sneed was involved with dealing drugs, and that people had gone in and out of the house or had been by the house during the period of time before the burglary actually took place, which was an issue at trial, was that nobody else would have had access except for Mr. McKeever. And Mr. McKeever testified to this, and if his testimony had been the only testimony heard at the hearing, I cannot sit here and in good faith say that that would be enough. However, the fact of the matter is that Mr. McKeever's own attorney did not dispute anything that he said. He actually corroborated it to an extent. He said
the attorney said was two, that Mr. McKeever told him about two of the witnesses, not all the ones that Mr. McKeever testified to. And as to those two witnesses, all that he said was that Mr. Sneed had dealt drugs in the past, but had said nothing about the 36 to 48 hour period between when the pills were gotten from the pharmacy to when the theft happened. Is that correct?
I believe that's partially correct, Your Honor, and not to dispute with you. However, I think that what was testified
your job is to dispute me if I'm wrong.
Yes, Judge. The trial counsel testified to is yes. He first testified that Mr. McKeever told him about the two witnesses and that they had been dealt drugs by Mr. Sneed. He actually originally did not even say in the past. It was just a general expression. And then when it came to the other witnesses that were mentioned, I think it was closer to trial, he could not recall what the context of the conversation was. He remembered that he had been disclosed the witnesses, but he couldn't remember what they had discussed between himself and Mr. McKeever about what the substance was. So it's our position that there was a conversation that was had. He's not disputing what Mr. McKeever said as to those three witnesses, but even just accepting the other two witnesses on its face, those two witnesses in and of themselves, the fact that they had done dealings with Mr. Sneed involving prescription pills at any point in time, until counsel went and spoke with these witnesses, counsel wouldn't have had any idea that
But we can't say on prejudice prong that there would be a reasonable probability of a different result if he had dealt drugs sometime in the past. In fact, frankly, that testimony may not have ever come in because it's not necessarily relevant to the question that was before the court, which is how many pills were in that bottle. That really is the only question that was before the jury. And so he having dealt drugs sometime in the past is not terribly relevant. For both prejudice purposes and I'm not even sure for deficiency purposes, for the actual question that was before the jury. So I guess I go back to, from my perspective, the question that Judge Brasher asked, which is my question, which is, as I understand it, we look at could have the state court, where it didn't give us reasons, have reasonably reached the conclusion that it did, where these witnesses never came and testified. Why is that not a reasonable and why is it unreasonable for the state court to have reached that conclusion where somebody makes a claim of other witnesses and those other witnesses don't show up at the hearing?
Yeah, I think it's unreasonable because it just kind of goes back to what counsel said. His testimony was not necessarily that it happened in the past. The testimony was that these drugs had been sold to other people in the neighborhood. And then Mr. McKeever corroborated that by saying that it was not only in the past, but it was in the days leading up. So I think that the point of our argument is that taking those two individual's testimony together, there was no testimony that was in dispute. The state never even argued at the trial court that he had not established that element of deficiency.
Who has the burden?
Mr. McKeever does have the burden.
Right. So while the 50C's opinion is not a model of clarity, I should leave it there. It did say that there was a failure to meet the burden. That is the one thing they did say, right?
That is correct.
Right. So I guess, is it unreasonable, not that it's wrong, but is it unreasonable? Could no jurist, no fair-minded jurist, which is the standard, have reached the conclusion based on this record that Mr. McKeever did not meet its burden? Again, not whether you and I sitting there would have reached that conclusion, but could no fair-minded jurist have reached that conclusion?
It's still our position, Your Honor, that it is unreasonable. And I think it goes beyond what just these witnesses could have testified to. And I think the district court mentioned the way that they phrased it was that the evidence of possible drug dealings with Mr. Sneed, not even just witnesses testifying, but that being an alternate theory, I think that is where it becomes unreasonable based on what the facts were at the trial and based on what everyone knew. There was no dispute that the defense originally intended to argue that Mr. Sneed had sold drugs. There was a motion in limine about it because the state did not want that evidence coming in after they learned about it before trial. So So that's all within the record before the court. So based on that, I think that it's our position that it is unreasonable based on what is in the record, what was the evidence established, regardless of whether or not these witnesses testified. The evidence established that individuals were available to testify about drug use with Mr. Sneed involving prescription pills close to or around the time of the burglary. And if those people would have been called or even investigated and questions could have been asked of Mr. Sneed, an alternative theory could have been presented, then the outcome of this case would have been different. And that is why it's our position that the District Court of Appeals opinion is unreasonable.
Could the state court, sorry, Judge Bratcher, go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, you're running out of time. I wanted to ask you a question about the second issue, if you don't mind.
Of course.
Which is, so the second issue is the one about whether Mr. Sneed's convictions should have been discovered and brought in. And the question I have is what would the theory be as to why Mr. Sneed was lying about the number of pills in the bottle? The convictions would seem to be very useful if there were a theory about why he was lying, but I just can't figure, I mean, I assume you have one, so I'm just curious.
I think that they're important for two reasons. Number one, obviously anybody that has been convicted of a felony, that's important to know as an impeachment purpose, especially when the issue of credibility is so critical, which it was in this case. It literally was the state's entire closing argument was that Mr. Sneed versus Mr. McKeever, who are you going to believe more? A 20-year-old drug addict who could not remember what he said or did. And then you have this perfect pedestal of a witness who can tell you exactly how many pills he took on what day. So I think that's the first point. The second point is, unfortunately, the theory that Mr. Sneed was, and again, this would all kind of go cumulatively with the other issues if another theory had been presented, that Mr. Sneed's priors, he was somebody that was not believable and he had involved himself in pills in the past and drugs, and he was not somebody that was just an innocent bystander. He had a reason to lie about the number of pills that were in the bottle because he himself was someone that had dispersed them and they were not actually stolen by Mr. McKeever as the state alleged that he had.
And I think
if he was dealing drugs, he did. I mean,
I'm sorry, Ron. It cut out a little bit. I apologize.
If Mr. Sneed was dealing drugs, he wouldn't want people to know that, right? I mean,
exactly.
I think that's right, but it just seems like these two issues go together. It seems like without the first issue to show that he was dealing drugs, the fact that he has these 20-some-odd-year-old convictions doesn't really stand on its own to do anything. I mean,
and Your Honor, I do understand that point and that statement. However, I think that even without the first issue, I think the second issue is still a very important issue because it's not just about the fact that he was dealing drugs. It's the fact that he had been a convicted felon. And I think because of the criticalness of his testimony, I think any impeachment in this case would have been important and the court would have found any convictions relevant to his impeachment. So I see that my time has run out. I will save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Robin Compton, Assistant Attorney General representing the Secretary, Florida Department of Corrections in this case. It's our position that this was an adjudication on the merits in state court and therefore deference is due that decision. And deference is due as to its findings of fact, the mixed findings of law and fact, and the conclusions of law. The 5th DCA decision reversed after finding that the defendant had failed to prove both prongs of Strickland. So the only thing left for the federal court to determine is what supported or could have supported the last state court decision. And it was not an unreasonable determination of Strickland. It's our position that that the appellant clearly failed to demonstrate prejudice in this case. He would have had to demonstrate that there was a reasonable probability that the jury could have found the quantity of the oxycodone to be below 28 grams. Now, in Florida, under 3850 F8B, it's the defendant's burden at an evidentiary hearing to prove his claim and present his evidence. So even if the witnesses would have said what he says they would have said, first of all, we got three prescription bottles. It wasn't just the oxycodone. There was also Soma and methadone. And taking his testimony as to what he said the witnesses would have said, they don't say which drugs would have impacted the trafficking amount. It was just a general, they would testify to drug activity. Also, those witnesses don't testify to any specific amounts of drugs taken. So therefore, that wouldn't have impacted what the trafficking amount was also. It's all speculation. Post-conviction relief cannot be based on speculative assertions. His testimony
was... this is Beverly Martin. The only reasoned opinion that we have in this case is the trial court opinion, who heard evidence. I read the transcript from that hearing, and the state habeas judge, found fact of performance, and there was prejudice to Mr. McKeever. So your position is we can't look at that at all?
Well, the 5th DCA vacated that order and reversed it. So we have to go on the last state court decision, which was the 5th.
We do not look through to the last reasoned opinion. That's your position.
Correct.
Okay.
So I don't know if y'all have that before you or not, but I filed a letter of supplemental authority on Friday, Reddick versus Secretary. And in that case, the issue was ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to call a witness and produce some medical reports. And the court found that the defendant had failed to establish prejudice, where he offered nothing but his own self-serving speculations as to what the witnesses would have testified to. And the court found that his failure to obtain that testimony at the hearing reduced his claim of prejudice to speculation. And that case was out of the district court for the Northern District of Tallahassee, but there was that particular cited to a lot of the case law out of the 11th. So,
can I ask you a question about, so I think your stronger argument is prejudice, but I do have some concerns. I have some concerns about deficient performance. I mean, it does seem like the lawyer here basically did nothing to try to present a case on behalf of his client.
Well, he was stuck between a rock and a hard place because he had the appellant's testimony from the beginning that the prescription bottle was full of medication, even though it was an uphill battle. The defendant had already pled to two burglaries and the theft of the prescriptions. So, I don't know what more defense counsel could have done when the defendant is telling him that the prescription bottles were full and the only witnesses he gave him the morning of trial, well, before the morning of trial, was the two witnesses that just would have said that there was, that they had bought pills in the past. And granted, I don't think they specifically said in the past, but he certainly, defense counsel testified, he was not left with the impression that he had bought within the 48-hour period.
Wouldn't that be relevant, though? I mean, wouldn't it at least show that there was some explanation for how the pills would have dissipated? I mean, I see the problem for the defendant here, I think, is that the pharmacist comes in and testifies, look, yesterday or 2 days before, I gave full pill bottle to Sneed. And then the defendant never has any theory at all for how those would have dissipated. I mean,
yeah, there was a theory. The theory was that his testimony at trial was that he didn't know, he was so high at the time that he broke into the house that he didn't know how many pills he was going to take. And so their defense theory was reasonable doubt as to a trafficking amount. And defendant agreed with that. Defendant agreed to that defense.
I don't understand that theory. So the theory was that he just didn't know how many pills were in the bottle, therefore he could not have.
No. No, the defendant testified that he didn't know how many pills he had taken, because his testimony at trial was that all he remembered was going in and sitting back on the bed, throwing back, eating pills. So, you know, defense counsel also had to deal with a statement that the defendant had given to law enforcement, which the law enforcement officer asked him, did you take prescription bottles full of medicine out of that residence? And he said, yes. So he didn't say they were half full. He didn't say they were partially full. He said they were, he acknowledged, yes, they were full of medicine. So, you know, he consented to the strategy, and based on at the evidentiary hearing, what the defendant was telling him was just that, you know, we only had drug activity in the past, nothing current. So, you know, I'll acknowledge that it's definitely a harder road for me to prove deficient performance than it is for the prejudice. But, you know, under Strickland, you got to prove both to be able to be entitled to relief. And he just can't demonstrate the prejudice.
Going back to the trial, I mean, you agree with me that it was the government's burden to show the trafficking amount.
Yes.
And the only testimony, as I understand it, was that Mr. McKeever had eaten all the drugs that he took, right? I mean, I never saw any evidence that there was any other theory. I mean, there was no other explanation for where the drugs went, right?
Well, except that I think it was probably argued in closing, and the defense attorney brought it out on cross of the victim that the house had been left unsecured for 2 days. And so therefore, you know, because it was unsecured and the drugs were in there, anybody could have gotten it.
No, but I mean, in terms of the amount that Mr. McKeever took, I mean, there was no evidence except that he ate whatever drugs he took.
Yes, I would agree with that.
I'm just curious. I mean, it's been a long time since I've been a trial lawyer, but I mean, did anybody look? So his testimony, at least in the habeas proceeding, was, you know, that he was already so high, like he had taken a whole bunch of Xanax, I believe it was.
Yes.
At the time he stole this, and then he just took the whole bottle. I mean, did anybody look into the fact whether somebody could physically survive that many pills? 53 pills, I think, would be the minimum for the trafficking amount.
No, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
I think the answer is no. Nobody explored that route, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about that? Because my understanding from the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that no one ever recovered the pill bottles. So although Mr. McKeever said that he took all the pills in the bottle, we don't actually know where the pills went because the pill bottles were never recovered. So for all we know, he was just lying and he sold the pills to somebody else.
Well, that's correct.
It's your burden, and there's no other explanation from the trial record. This was just the point I was trying to make.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Moving on to issue two, the failure to impeach with the prior convictions. It's just our position that it's not a substantial claim under Martinez. Counsel, there is testimony at the evidentiary hearing that counsel says he ran the criminal history of John Sneed. And I think it's clear if you look at document 10, exhibit R33, he was not referring to his son. His son's name was John Sneed also, but when you read it in context, it's clearly he was referring to the victim, not his son, when he said that he ran the criminal history of John Sneed. Plus, I think he did take John Sneed's deposition. So,
and you're talking about Mr. Grant now, right?
No, I'm talking about trial counsel said he ran the criminal history.
Okay.
And that's at exhibit R, page 33. Yes, the victim. Okay. The victim. Trial counsel says that he ran the criminal history of John Sneed. So that's at Exhibit R, page 33.
But he never, I mean, but the record doesn't reflect that he used that or told Mr. McKeever about it. I mean,
no, right. Because we don't really know, you know, these attachments that he has to the record on the felony convictions, it's from people verified. And it doesn't say what state they're from, what statute numbers he was convicted under, as far as the victim goes. So, you know, we don't even know exactly what those are, if he even had the prior felony convictions.
I understand.
They were very unspecific.
I guess the question is, you know, if you're exploring whether somebody was effective as counsel or ineffective as counsel, ordering the criminal history and then just, you know, for a hypothetical, not looking at it, that doesn't really improve the performance of counsel, does it?
No, but we don't know that he didn't look at it. We just know that he didn't make any issue of it. And that could be easily resolved because because there wasn't anything there. Maybe they were withholds. Maybe they weren't even, maybe they were pretrial interventions.
I want to ask you about a hearing that happened on the record that I'm trying to figure out the basis of this hearing. So there was a motion in limine hearing that I think you talk about in your brief, and the district court talks about, where this issue of the criminal history or the criminal conduct of Snead comes up.
Yes.
And the government has moved to prevent the introduction of that. And then the defendant and his lawyer talk to each other, and the defendant's lawyer says, look, we've agreed, we're not going to bring that up. So it does seem that at some point, somebody knew something about this criminal history, either the convictions or this other stuff. And that was just a decision not to bring it up. And do we know anything else about what led to that hearing?
As far as why he didn't bring it up? No.
What they were talking about. What was this? What was the nature of the motion, government's motion in limine?
The state had moved in limine to keep out this information because they had heard the through jail calls where the defendant, it looked like that was the way he was going, was that he wanted to submit this reputation testimony of the victim. And it was just reputation testimony. It would have had nothing to do with the current amount of pills that were in the bottle. And I think that's what defense counsel testified to. That's why he didn't bring it up. Because even at the point of trial, the defendant was still telling him it was, he took the whole bottle, that the bottles were full.
Didn't Mr. Lamberti testify that Mr. McKeever told him at that hearing as it was going on to not call any witnesses because it would, quote, be a waste of time?
Yes, he did. So that's another reason why he didn't call any witnesses. And that's why they went ahead and agreed to the motion in limine to keep out that kind of evidence. And, you know, we don't know that any of that stuff would have been admissible anyway.
Judge Martin, can I have an indulgence for one or two questions from the...
Of course.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll make it quick. Counsel, on this issue of the prior convictions regarding the prejudice prong, not necessarily the deficiency prong, do we know if there's a reasonable probability that this would have changed the result, where we do or do not know if the state court would ever have allowed in 25 and 30 year old convictions? And then related to that, is there a case law in the state of Florida would suggest that those convictions do not necessarily come in and at least require some sort of weighing or balancing by the court before they do come in, or they are that old?
Well, the law in Florida is that it's discretionary with the trial judge on whether or not convictions that old would come in, and they do have to do a 9403 weighing analysis to make that determination. So there's no guarantee that these would have ever come in.
Is there a case law that you even cited in your brief, which suggests that a 30-year-old conviction, that trial judges have not allowed them in, and that's been affirmed by the courts of the district courts?
Well, not that I found.
You didn't cite Jones in your brief? I thought you had.
Maybe I did. Let me look.
While you're looking,
it's hard to remember the hundreds of cases. No, I don't have Jones.
While That's all I had, Judge Martin. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. All right, and we'd ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Ms. Reese?
Thank you, Mike. Please, the court. First, just kind of working backwards. First, Judge Luck mentioned the fact that Mr. McKeever, that Mr. Lamberti testified that Mr. McKeever told him that he did not want him to call anybody else at the motion in limine, and that was testified to at the evidentiary hearing. The point that I thought is important is that Mr. McKeever disputed that and said that that's not something that, that's not what they were discussing off the record. And the state court obviously agreed that Mr. McKeever was more credible because it ultimately chose to disagree with Mr. Lamberti's allegations and whatever his strategic reasons were for not doing things. So it's our position that anything that was in dispute, the state court factually found Mr. McKeever was more credible.
That goes to the look-through issue. And so let's talk about that for a minute. What is the law on look-through? When do you look through?
So the law on look-through is that when the last court that made a legal finding, which in this case would be the Fifth District Court of Appeal, when they make a finding, but they don't make any factual findings, the court is allowed to look through to the last written opinion that did make findings.
A little more nuanced. It's a little more nuanced than that. So I'm going to quote from Wilson versus Sellers, which is sort of the seminal look-through case. And there, what the court said, and this is literally the holding, it says, "We hold that the federal court should look through the unexplained decision to the last related state court decision that does provide a relevant rationale." So there's a few things there. A, is the 50CA's opinion unexplained where it says we find that it didn't meet its burden? And secondly, in other words, unlike the situation in Sellers where it just said affirmed or denied. And secondly, does the underlying opinion here, the state court habeas opinion, provide a relevant rationale that would we look through? In other words, if the 50CA had affirmed, then of course the relevant rationale would be underneath. But if since it went the opposite way, can we say that the state habeas court gave a relevant rationale?
And Your Honor, yes. Now, first of all, it is our position that the 50CA's opinion is almost synonymous to saying that it was affirmed or reversed, because all they're saying is that he did not satisfy these prongs. There's no explanation. There's no findings associated with that. So it would be the equivalent of saying that this is reversed and the trial court's order is vacated. So that is our position on that. As to the second prong about it being relevant, it's our position that the findings below are absolutely relevant because the trial court was the only person in a posture to see these witnesses. The trial court also was there for the trial. It was the same trial court judge. The only person, as this court and all the courts have said, credibility findings, we obviously don't have the ability to look back on a video. So we have to go back and look at those factual findings, and it's our position on that. Those are absolutely relevant to this specific issue. And I see that my time is about to run out. I would ask the courts to reverse the district court's findings and rule in Mr. McKeever's favor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Reese, and thank you, Ms. Compton. I know, Ms. Reese, Judge Joe Flatt asked you to help the court by representing Mr. McKeever, and you have done so very well, and we appreciate your help.
Thank you, Judge.
And always, we appreciate the help from the state as well, Ms. Compton.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Y'all have a good day.
Thank
Stay
you.
Safe.